Mr. Wilson, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I hope everyone can hear me.
We can.
Thank you. I'll just reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. My name is Mike Wilson. I represent the appellant in this matter, Brian Doerr. Mr. Doerr has raised 5 assignments of error in this case. What I'll do is focus on 2 of those assignments, as they are the first 2, as they are the bulk of the assets and controversy on appeal. So Mr. Doerr, and I'll refer to them as Brian and Tammy, they divorced in Dodge County, and there wasn't really much at issue other than property. And so Judge Hall issued his opinion there, and we do take issue with a few aspects of that opinion. And I will note, since the briefing was completed in this case, this court has released an opinion at the end of January, White v. White. And that opinion, I think, does have some bearing on the issues here before the court today. In White v. White, well, first of all, just so you have the facts straight in our case, Mr. Doerr, Brian, he had a house, I'll refer to it as the Fontenelle home, that the parties have not disputed was premarital. And what he did was he sold that house, and there was a balance sheet that was introduced as evidence showing that approximately $2,000 of that went to help pay off the mortgage on a home that the parties lived in. It was purchased right around the time of the marriage. Now, the court ultimately determined that that home was valued at $350,000. That's a matter that we've contested. I won't get into too much of that today. But what it did was it split the entire value of that home down the middle, only accounting for a $10,000 difference in what it found was the difference between the down payments made by the two parties. It found that Brian made a $50,000 down payment while Tammy made a $40,000 down payment. We've challenged that finding as well, but again, I want to get back to this $202,000 that came from my client's premarital property. So what they did, what the court found, was that this entire house should be split down the middle. It found that it could not trace the Fontenelle proceeds to the Howard Street home, despite the fact that there was a settlement sheet showing that this $202,483 was used to pay a loan from Fremont Bank. And the parties both testified that this is where the proceeds went to pay off the mortgage on the marital residence, which I'll refer to as the Howard Street residence.
Mr. Wilson, Wilson, you understand or recognize that your client had the burden of proof on this issue. So what's your best argument that he sustained that burden of proof in light of the trial court's finding to the contrary?
So my best argument relies not only on the documentary evidence that I've already mentioned, but on the testimony of the parties. And actually, what I'll do is I mentioned that White v. White case, and Your Honor, Justice Castle wrote the opinion on that. And what the court found in that case is that, and in that case, what you had is you had stock, and you had stock that was put into an account via an inheritance. Now that stock, some of it was used to purchase ETFs. I'm not a stock guru, so I can't remember exactly what that stands for. But in other words, a lot of that account was used to convert it into other assets. Okay. But there were 6,500 shares of ConAgra stock that was inherited and gifted to Tim that was never changed, was never moved, was never converted to other assets. And there was really no dispute in the evidence as to the fact that 6,500 shares of stock wasn't converted into other assets. It was, so in other words, it remained traceable. And what my argument, and so my argument in this case is the $202,000that came from the sale of the Fontenelle home remains traceable because you do not have any conversion of that asset once it's placed in the Howard Street home. There's no testimony that it was converted into any other assets. In fact, the testimony is in agreement that that money was used to pay off the mortgage. And then there's no testimony where it went.
What did the district court judge say in regard to that evidence?
He merely said that there wasn't sufficient evidence or sufficient. He said the documentary evidence wasn't sufficient, is basically what the district court said. For him to find that Mr. Dorr, Brian, met his burden of showing that those proceeds were traceable back to his Fontenelle home.
What is our standard for reviewing what the district court judge did?
Abuse of discretion, Your Honor. And that's the standard that this court applied in White v. White. And the court found in that case, White v. White, that the district court judge did abuse her discretion by finding that that entire stock account should be split down the middle. And ultimately, what I'm trying to do is draw a parallel here between the stock, the 6,500 shares of ConAgra stock that had remained in that account in White. And draw a parallel between that and the $202,000 that came from this Fontenelle home into the Howard Street home in this case. There's also another $150,000 that the parties do not dispute that came from this Fontenelle home and went into a specific bank account. And the testimony, again, is not in dispute as to where that money went. And there are bank records and the settlement sheet from the sale of the Fontenelle home showing exactly where that money went. So,
counsel, yes. Sometimes parties in dissolution cases like this sort of expect their trial judge to be a forensic accountant, right? And they present a lot of documentary evidence, and the math doesn't just really add up on any of it perfectly. Is this one of those cases? And if so, did the judge do anything wrong?
Thank you. That's a good question, Your Honor. And I believe, no, this is not one of those cases. And I don't believe that the judge did a good job discerning the evidence in between the documentary and testimonial evidence that was presented, as well as the bank records. If you look at the numbers, and you don't have to be a forensic accountant, I believe, because I'm certainly not. I'm terrible with math, Your Honor. But I can tell you that when you look at the destinations, and there were only two destinations for the proceeds from the sale of this Fontenelle home. The one destination was the Howard Street home. The second destination was this INS money market account, which was then Miss Tammy emptied. She took approximately over $100,000 and put it into another account without Brian's permission when the parties separated. So those two accounts are the only destinations where the proceeds of this went. There's no dispute between the parties as to where these proceeds went. And if you look at the settlement sheet from the sale of the Fontenelle home, you can see that, you know, there's a payoff to the mortgage of about $202,000. And then yes, it's not a coincidence that $150,000 is the amount that appears in the INS money market account.
Is it an abuse of discretion for the trial judge to have arguably failed to connect the dots?
I believe so, Your Honor. Yes. And I think that's what you found in White. I think you found that the judge in that case failed to connect the dots. And ultimately, that's our argument on appeal. I think what I'll do is I'll reserve the last couple of minutes here for rebuttal if I have time left.
Mr. Wilson, before you sit down figuratively, in White,
yes.
we were talking about 6,500 shares of stock that existed at the beginning and that never left. Here we're talking about an asset that changed from a house somewhere to money and your argument is it then went into a different house. Isn't that a fair characterization of your argument?
It is, Your Honor. But the question before the court is not what kind of baskets we have here. The question is, where is that money or that asset traceable from one basket to the other? And in this case, just like the 6,500 shares of stock were traceable into this particular account and did not go anywhere, this $202,000, for instance, from the sale of the Fontenelle home was traceable into the Howard Street home and did not go anywhere.
It wasn't converted. My problem with the analogy is in White, there really weren't any dots to connect. It was there and it always stayed there. Here it does look like there are, to use the metaphor that's been described, dots to connect. And that seems to me to be distinguishable, but I'll let you manage the rest of your time.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. Mr. Tassett, good morning to you.
Can you unmute, Mr. Tassett?
I apologize. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning to all of you, and may it please the court. This case is governed by the standard of review, much like the Burkhart case that I cited in my brief and that's discussed in the appellant's reply brief. The real question is whether the judge abused his discretion by failing to fill in the gaps in the evidence presented by the appellant Brian in this case. And along with that question, to further the metaphor that's been discussed earlier today, the question is, the judge clearly should be connecting the dots. The issue in this case is there aren't enough dots to make it clear as to how those dots should be connected. This case, should Brian's theory have been credited in the trial court, would have been relatively easy for the judge to connect the dots if the proper documents were presented. Mr. Doerr, during the course of the trial, produced bank records and settlement sheets and other documentary evidence, and clearly, through the course of discovery in the case, had an opportunity to adduce all of the documentary evidence that would have been required to permit the judge to credit his theory in the event that the theory was creditable. And our contention on appeal is, defending this judgment, is that the judge did not find that the documentary evidence produced by Brian provided the direct linkage that the judge was looking for in order to permit the judge to do what Brian asked him to do. There is...
Mr. Tassett?
Yes, Your Honor. Excuse me.
Mr. Tassett, what evidence is lacking on the proceeds from the sale of the Fontenelle house going to the payment of the debt at the Fremont Bank? What evidence is lacking?
The amount, evidence of the specific amount. Parties agreed, Your Honor, that during the trial, the parties agreed that proceeds from the Fontenelle house were used to retire the mortgage on Howard Street. That, as Mr. Wilson indicates, and as the record shows, there wasn't much disagreement about that at the trial. The issue is that the specific amount is not referenced or identified or proved, I guess, to use the terminology that may apply, was not proved to the satisfaction of the trial court. There should be, and of course there probably would be, a document or more than one document that would establish exactly the amount that was paid from Fontenelle for the retirement of the Howard Street address mortgage, and that amount simply isn't in the record. We have a settlement sheet showing that a loan was paid off from the proceeds, but we don't have any connection between that payoff and the mortgage on Howard Street. So the judge could have, I think, as I indicated before, I think the standard of review should govern the resolution of this appeal. I think Mr. Wilson is right. The judge could have filled in some of these gaps for Mr. Doerr in his documentary evidence and could have credited his testimony more than the judge elected to do. But the judge sat through the trial, which occurred over the course of what I recall to be several days over several weeks, and studied the evidence. It's clear from reading his opinion, he understood Mr. Doerr's theory of the case. He understood Mr. Doar's contentions, but the documentary evidence permitting the judge to connect the dots to get to the place Mr. Doar wanted him to be simply did not exist. And
are you suggesting that there's a credibility issue here also?
And Your Honor, I apologize. Could you repeat your question? I apologize.
Are there credibility issues that the trial judge made in this case that ultimately determined the final outcome?
I think some of that played into it. One of the interesting parts of trying cases like this is and particularly from the trial judge's perspective, I think there's truth a lot of times mixed in with matters that aren't entirely true. And the judge's job, being present front and center for the presentation of the testimony, the judge's job is to try to sort through that. In this case, the district judge credited part of Brian's testimony and specifically did so with respect to his claims regarding the down payment on the Howard Street residence. And he says that in his order, that he did credit Mr. Doar's testimony. But there were other portions of Mr. Doar's testimony, which, and this is going to involve me speculating a little bit about what the judge may have been thinking, but there are other portions of Mr. Doar's testimony that could have soured the judge against Mr. Doar and caused the judge to view Mr. Doar's claims with a little bit of a jaundiced eye, to include specifically Mr. Doar's version of the events that were recounted in the trial record, where he was charged and convicted with assaulting Tammy during the course of the marriage. But he elected to take the stand, even though he pleaded guilty to the offense, he elected to take the witness stand in the divorce case and claim that Mrs. Doar fell on her own accord up against the back of the steps. And he intimated during that testimony that somehow he was wrongfully convicted. That kind of thing during the course of a trial, and again, I'm speculating, but just to answer your question, that sort of thing could have certainly compromised the judge's view of Brian's credibility to the point where he elected not to credit Brian's testimony to the extent that Brian did testify about the tracing issues in the case. And then with the clear failings of the documentary evidence, those two things operating together, I think, just caused the judge to not credit Brian's tracing argument in that respect.
There's been a lot of discussion today about connecting the dots and documentary evidence. How exact does that evidence have to be? What is the point at which a trial court judge abuses their discretion?
Well, the point has not been reached in this case, Your Honor, and it's difficult for me to say and articulate a rule that could be useful in cases across the board. I think it's useful to think of this appeal in this fashion, which is that, as I indicated before, all of this information, these financial transactions having to do with payoffs of mortgages and settlement statements and bank accounts, all of that, all of those matters are readily provable with reference to documentary evidence. We know from the trial record in this case that some documentary evidence was produced, but we also know from the trial record that a lot of documentary evidence, or maybe some, I guess, was not produced. I think that a rule to the extent that one needs to be fashioned, it could be said that should documentary evidence be reasonably available to prove a claim like Brian's claim in this case, it should be produced. And if it isn't, much like the litigants in Burkhardt, if it isn't produced, then the party who fails to produce those records does so at their peril. In Burkhardt, there weren't records, but the judge credited Mr. Burkhardt, and this court ratified the judge's determination to credit Mr. Burkhardt's testimony. And similarly, in this case, Tammy prevailed at the trial, and the trial judge acknowledged Brian's theories but rejected them. And that's the way that I believe this case should be handled on appeal, which is through the standard of review. To answer the question that was posed to Mr. Wilson at the end of his argument, the standard of review specifically is, this court is not inclined to disturb a division of property made by the trial court unless it's patently unfair on the record. And I don't think there's anything about this record that demonstrates that this result was patently unfair, given the judge's reasoning.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal.
I asked Mr. Wilson a question or made an observation at the very end of his time that he didn't have a chance to respond to. With your indulgence, could I ask to give him a brief time to do so?
Certainly. Yeah, do you want to refresh Mr. Wilson's memory?
Well, I was talking about the white versus white distinction.
Yes, Your Honor, and thank you for giving me a chance to respond. I appreciate that. So this is the way I see the white case playing into this. All right. Just like a stock transfer or an inheritance, non-marital property, property that's brought into the marriage or that was owned prior to the marriage is exempt from division. So what I'm asking the court to do with White is compare the 6,500 shares of stock that Mr. White received through an inheritance to the premarital property in this case. And ultimately what the court did there was it found that the trial judge did abuse her discretion in dividing that 6,500 shares of stock because there was documentary evidence and there was the testimony of both parties, which is exactly what we have in this case, the testimony of both parties. It's not just Brian's theory as to where this money came from, this $202,000 that was used to pay off. Tammy herself testified that those proceeds went to pay off the Howard Street home. And I've got multiple citations in my brief to that. But ultimately, what I want the court to do is see that 6,500 as shares of stock as the same as being the same as this money that comes into the Howard Street home from Mr. Doar's premarital property. And because, yes.
Okay. I don't think there are further questions. So we will go on to the next case, which is State versus, I'm going to pronounce this, Seda.